Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com. It's time for Floss Weekly with Leo Laporte and John O'Bacon, episode 86 for September 12th, 2009, Ardor. This show is brought to you by listeners like you and your contributions. We couldn't do it without you. Thanks so much. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show that covers free Libra and open source software. Randall Schwartz, normally with us at this hour, is taking the week off so he can actually make a living. Who would have thunk it? But John O'Bacon is here. John, of course, from the Ubuntu community and the Art of Community book, which is a wonderful book you can read from Amazon and all the other finer bookstores from O'Reilly. And John, today we're going to talk true love.
Oh, yeah.
Ardor. Yeah, baby. Ardor. What is Ardor?
Ardor is a pretty rock and roll digital audio environment available for Linux and Mac. Ah. And Ardor is kind of like basically the best that we've got right now in terms of professional audio editing for people who want to record bands and podcasts and do anything else.
I have never heard of it. Have you tried it?
I have tried it a few times. And, you know, I've had pretty good results with it, but it's a little complex for me. It's definitely for the more intellectual, professionally minded of us.
Yeah.
But it's really good, and on today's show we've got the main man who's the founder of Ardor and who's the lead developer as
Very
well.
Very exciting. Paul, we're going to talk to
Paul Davis.
Paul Davis will join us in a second. Next week I should mention Kent Beck. I've looked it up. We'll talk about patterns. Remember? Yeah, that's exciting. Will you be here for that? Because I'm just gonna have to nod off.
I'm going to be here, and I'm going to be listening.
We'll let Randall do the heavy lifting next week because it's about programming.
I think Randall's a bit of a super fan. I think he thinks Kent Beck is his BFF or something.
Yeah.
So,
he's quite famous. It's a little beyond me. But I actually be very interested in learning more about the latest theory in computer programming. But let's right now go to the beautiful Balakinwood, which is either in Pennsylvania or Wales. Which is it, Paul?
It's in Pennsylvania, an area that was settled by the Welsh in the 1700s. 1600s, even, I think.
How do you pronounce that? Balakinwood?
Balakinwood, yes.
Is there a Balakinwood, Wales?
It's actually two villages, one called Bala, one called Kinwood.
Ah.
And we are surrounded by other small Welsh villages, such as Narberth and Tredyffrin and Merion and so on and so forth.
Wow. And are you a native of Pennsylvania? You don't sound like it.
No, I'm originally from London, but I've been in the States for about 20 years now. So
yeah, so it's starting to fade.
Some people think so.
Jono and I are kind of excited about this because we're both self-confessed audio geeks.
Yes, indeed.
That makes three of us.
Well, do you want to kick off by just telling us what Ardor is? And let's start with what Ardor is and then we'll talk about how we got started.
Well, Ardor is, I guess, fits into a category of programs that are generally called a digital audio workstation, which doesn't really help to describe it in much detail. It's just a useful label. Essentially, it's a program for recording, editing, mixing, and processing sound. Generally, the idea is that you're probably making some kind of piece of music, perhaps to go along with a soundtrack or a standalone piece of music. But in theory, you could be using it for podcast edits and so on and so forth. Essentially, if you need to record, edit, mix, or process sound, the idea is that Ardor should be a program that's of significant use to you.
Now, I think a lot of us are familiar with Audacity as the open source kind of sound editor, if not of choice, of being the only one out there. Everybody knows about Audacity. Comes free with a lot of stuff. It's Linux, it's OS X, it's even Windows. How would you contrast Ardor with Audacity?
Audacity's been a very successful program, and there are times when I'm quite envious of the multi-platform support they've had and the way it's penetrated the marketplace. But Audacity is quite different from Otter in the sense that it started life, and to a large extent still is, intended to be a sound file editor.
Right.
That is, it was created with the idea of allowing you to record and then manipulate single sound files. So you can, you know, you can load something into it, chop the end of it off, chop the start of it off, chop some things out in the middle, add some effects and so on. It's only very recently that Audacity has started playing around with the idea that actually you may need to work with lots of sound files. You may need to work with lots of tracks and lots of channels. And although they've made some significant progress in that direction, my general feeling is they're going to find that there are some limitations in their architecture because they started as a sound file editor. If you look at the world of proprietary software, there are clear analogies there where there are plenty of people, for example, who like to use programs like BiasPeak on the Mac,
right,
which is just a sound file editor. And I don't think anyone would really seriously suggest that it was a digital audio workstation that you would use to do multi-track recording, for example. So the relationship between Audacity and Otter is a lot like that. Audacity is a great sound file editor, and Otter is a multi-track recorder and digital workstation.
So what commercial products then are competing with you? Setting aside the fact that there's probably nothing on Linux.
That's correct, yeah. The main proprietary applications that I view as in the same sort of workspace as Otter would be Pro Tools as the clear number one there. And then we have other things like Cubase, Logic, Samplitude, Sonar. That's a pretty good list.
Yeah. So that gives people an idea of that's what a DAW is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So Otter is clearly there for an obvious use case would be a band who wants to record an album. They'd be able to plug in their guitars. They'd be able to plug in their, you know.
Yes, that's correct.
Or
drums, vocal mics, and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I'm using a commercial package called Audition on Windows. And actually, I'm downloading Otter right now just to check it out. Because I do multi-track recording, and Audacity, while it can do it, isn't, you're right, exactly, Paul, it's not really suited to that task. Mm-hmm. So, to be honest with you, I use Audition because I've never really been too happy. Pro Tools is overcomplicated for me. Apple's product Soundtrack Pro has got all sorts of issues. Mm. I've yet to find something I like as well on Linux or the Mac. So I'm installing Otter right now. I'm very interested in this.
Well, I would say that in general, we probably err on the side of being overly complex rather than overly simple. But it's certainly a goal of ours to, you know, evolve in a direction that makes it possible for users who don't need as much power as Pro Tools offers to actually be able to use Otter reasonably creatively.
Right.
There is even a version that we did for the SAE Institute, for example, in which quite a lot of the complexity was actually stripped out of the user interface. It's still not as simple as a sound file editor, but there were quite a lot of the more complicated operations that were removed, specifically with the idea of creating something that somebody who didn't really know much about how a digital workstation worked could actually sit down and usefully do something fairly quickly.
Right.
But but that's always going to be a work in progress. So
with Otter, I mean, I come from a Cubase background. I use Cubase in my studio, and I've always found it pretty easy to use. I've never really got on with Pro Tools either. I found it a little bit too complex. And I remember a while back, I evaluated Otter as an option to move over to Linux, and I found it very, very complex. Is the back end and the front end sufficiently separated so you can kind of, you know, put some lipstick on it and make it easy to use?
Yes, you absolutely can. The internal design of the program is firmly based around the idea that there's as close to a complete separation of the back end from the GUI as we can achieve. The back end doesn't even really know that there actually is a user interface at all. And that means that, in theory, it will be possible to construct completely different user interfaces around that back end. That we have actually done that rather a long time ago in the past. It's not, I think, that relevant now. But to illustrate the point, one of the first sponsorships of work on Otter, if you like, was paid for by a few blind or sight impaired audio engineers. And we basically created an interface around the Ardor backend that was completely keyboard driven. There was a very crude ASCII user interface, but the idea was that actually the people who would be using this wouldn't even really use that ASCII screen at all. They would just be using the keyboard. I don't think that actually builds anymore, but that separability still exists. And so it's quite possible to imagine if somebody wanted to put the work into building, you know, a super, super simplified version of an Ardor interface, then you could do that still based on that back end.
And is that a project that you're actively working on? Because, I mean, I remember I tried Ardor fairly recently. I'm running the development version of Ubuntu and I installed it from Ubuntu. So it's a pretty recent release. And I still found I feel my eyeballs kind of spinning round due to the complexity parts of the interface. Like, I don't care about bits and streams and any of these details. I just want to record music. Is that kind of how you're changing?
It's not a direction that currently I or any of the other developers are really paying too much attention to. We are very focused on workflow issues, which is, you know, where people can identify a specific task that they need to perform with the software. We definitely want to make sure that task is accomplishable with, you know, a minimal number of mouse clicks and keyboard operations and so on. But the general goal of trying to create a program that, for example, is as easy to use as GarageBand, which I think is a very nicely designed program for, you know, for people who are new to this sort of stuff, that's not a goal that we have right now. I think it's quite a difficult problem to solve. My experience so far has been that most people who use digital audio workstations have a list of things that they'd like to be able to do very easily. And they believe that the program that is before them ought to do those things very easily. And they're right. The problem is that there's a whole bunch of other people who have their own list of things it ought to be able to do very easily and straightforwardly. And when you take the union of all these lists, you end up with a program that looks like Pro Tools or like Ardor.
Right.
So you end up having to make some choices at some point where you say, okay, we are absolutely not going to cater to the following types of goals. We're going to limit it entirely to this set of things. And my experience so far has been that when you do that, you immediately run into the wrath of the user who says, well, it was great. I got started nice and quickly and I understood how to use it, but it doesn't do this. Are you crazy?
Right.
So, you know, we haven't really resolved that. And for the moment we're happier working on Ardor 3.0, which we can talk about as we roll along, as opposed to figuring out how do we build a really simple interface that's sort of roughly the equivalent of something like GarageBand. I think another way to put this is that for me, in the back of my head, I'm writing Ardor catering to either audio engineers or musicians with audio engineering skills. I'm not really writing it with the idea of targeting musicians who just don't do that sort of thing.
Just to clarify, you're kind of going for the professional and the semi-professional audio, kind of the, you know, those who are passionate about audio, people who want to, you know, produce bands professionally, or as opposed to kind of the hobbyist with a laptop who just wants to kind of put down some guitar tracks.
Yeah, that's certainly our general goal right now. Although I would say that I'm quite happy to come across, you know, quite significant amounts of feedback from new users who do report back to us saying, "Oh, it was really great. I just clicked a few buttons and, you know, it all worked." But I mean, certainly we're happy when that happens, but when there's not a lot of effort going into making things really easy for that second group that you mentioned.
Right. Gotcha. So, some time ago, when I was looking into Ardor and I thought it was a bit too complicated, as you know, Paul, I formed a project called Jacosha, which was kind of a simplified multi-track editor. I'm really interested by the fact that you say that the backend's completely separated, because Jacosha was kind of built from the perspective of just throwing away all the assumed knowledge about audio engineering and think of it from a completely new usability standpoint. So are you saying, therefore, that we could conceivably take Jacosha, the Jacosha interface, and then hook in the Ardor backend?
Yeah, you can do that. In fact, there's already a project whose name I wish I could give you right now, but I can't. There is a project already that took LibOrder, which is basically our back end, and they've I think that the project has died. I think there's no activity with it now, but they were attempting to build a completely modular workstation system where wow. rather than the whole thing being one program, there was a whole bunch of completely separate applications with their own windows and so on. And that was built on the LibOrder back end. There's also a theoretical effort by Jesse Chappell, who is the guy that wrote Freak Tweak and Super Looper. I'm not sure if Jesse will ever get to it. His life has moved on. He doesn't have a lot of time anymore, but he was planning to do a new version of Super Looper that would also be based on LibOrder as the back end rather than the current internals of Super Looper. So yeah, it's certainly quite possible to do that. The only thing I would say is that of the current code base of Arda, or approximately 75% of all the code is the GUI. So once you get up to talking about a fairly rich user interface with lots of things that pop up and bits of controllability, you probably will run into the situation where you realize that the back end actually is not that much code. And the really hard work is actually implementing the user interface.
And that's because you're using Jack as the back end. Could you explain what Jack is for our listeners?
Sure. Jack stands for the Jack Audio Connection Kit, thus continuing on a long line of self-referential Unix acronyms. Jack actually started out life in sort of two ways. There was a lot of discussion in among the Linux audio developers in the late 1990s and early 2000s. About the need to find some sort of way to get applications to talk to each other. We didn't have any good plug-in architecture at that point, so we had lots of people writing small pieces of audio software, and they inevitably wanted to take the audio output of one of them and feed it into another one, and there was really no way to do that. So there were a lot of discussions that went on to try to sort of flesh out in the abstract what this should do, and then maybe try to come up with some mechanisms. And the internal audio engine in Arda was sort of evolving in a direction that looked like it might be a suitable starting point to do this. So at some point in maybe 2001, 2002, I think, I split off that internal audio engine to its own project. That eventually mutated into Jack. And Jack is now a framework, essentially, you can look at it from two perspectives. From a user perspective, it's a program that allows you to connect arbitrary audio applications to each other and to your sound card. So you can be routing audio to and from a sound card, from a software synthesizer application to a recorder, to an effects processing unit, to an application that maybe streams the audio out onto the network or does all kinds of things with it. Essentially allowing you to create completely arbitrary routing for your audio signals and not have to get locked into this idea that audio just goes in and out of the sound card. From a programmer's perspective, it's an API, a programming interface that programmers can use that works at a very high level. They no longer have to think about the details of how do I access a sound card, how do I configure a sound card. They basically deal with a couple of very simple concepts. And their programs look exactly the same, regardless of where the audio is coming from or going to. And so this makes it possible to create new applications extremely simply. And once you've created them, they're able to participate with all other applications that can use Jack.
Right. And is the idea that the applications hide the complexity of the routing as well, so you can. You can in Ardour, you can kind of say, "Oh, I've got these other applications available in which I can route audio into Ardour, and then I can send audio out of Ardour." Is that kind of how it works?
It's up to the developer of a particular application. It's certainly quite possible to simply write an application uses Jack and have it have no connection management whatsoever. So the program just starts up. It basically says, "I've got some inputs, I've got some outputs, but they're not connected to anything." And I won't provide you with a user interface to connect them. And then you can use some other application, of which there are now several, to actually make and manage all the connections, or you can have an application such as Ardor, which offers its own connection management as well. Now, it's always possible to use these, if you like, third-party programs to actually make those connections if you want to. And some people do choose to do that. But Ardor does provide its own connection management, and quite a few other of the larger Jack applications all do the same thing, modeled on the idea that the user doesn't always want to have to go out to another window or application in order to connect this to that. It's really up to the developer how much of the sort of patch bay management type stuff they build into their own application. If they put nothing in there, it just means that the user needs to use Patchage or QJack Cuddle or some other similar application.
Gotcha.
Oh, disappeared, Jono. There he is. You've gone way beyond my limited expertise, so I'm just going to let you continue, Jono, as an audio geek. I just want to edit out ums and burps. That's all. I don't.
We can ask more of those if you want. So, so Paul, tell us about the kind of use that people have been. What have been people been using Ardor for? I mean, you must hear some wonderful case studies of your users.
Well, I hear lots of bits of music that people record, and I have to say that it's often a little unfortunate that this happens. As most people know, one's taste in music is rather subjective, and the chance that random individuals who are using Ardor are going to produce music that I happen to think is fantastic, it's probably a little slim.
But, what kind of music are you into?
I'm into a lot of different kinds of music, but most of it does not line up with most of the things that people have sent me so far. I have heard a wide range of music though. Everything from sort of solo blues guitar to hardcore metal, some classical vocal recordings. There was a guy a few years ago who did some very nice children's stories, actually, that were sort of spoken word things with light music in the background. There are a couple of small commercial studios that I know of who use it for, you know, a wide variety of clients that roll through their offices. There's a guy I know in the UK right now who's experimenting with Ardor as the backup recording rig in a set of big mobile trucks that they're using. He's been testing it himself for, you know, his own purposes for quite some time, and he's convinced the guys that actually own these rigs that it's probably up to the task of being used as the secondary backup, the backup recording system. So there's sort of a wide range. I would say at the moment we probably don't have as much penetration into the kinds of studios where, given what I said earlier about our sort of target audience, we haven't really penetrated that world to the extent that I would have hoped that we perhaps would have. I suppose that the most obvious example of us going in that direction perhaps comes out of a collaboration that I did with Harrison Consoles, who were one of the earliest sort of large-scale mixing desk companies. They've been around for about 30 years, and they have a product that is essentially Ardor boxed up in a custom-built computer. That has the user interface tweaked a little bit, and they sell that to post-production studios that are doing mostly the vocal post-production on Hollywood movies. There's a crazy workflow that these guys use there, and they traditionally use some hardware that's no longer being made anymore. And Harrison thought that this is an interesting case study to try to get people to actually start using Ardor. So, you know, that's sold as a product called the X-Dubber, and it's really specifically targeted at this crazy workflow that these guys use, but it is still just Ardor in a box, essentially. It's not a different program. It's hard to know what everyone's doing. I mean, my current estimate of the size of the user base is it's open source software, so it's always a little hard to tell. My guess is it's anywhere from probably 2,000 to 10,000 people.
That's great.
Most of those people are going to be at home with their guitars or this, you know, a keyboard or something. some of them are doing somewhat grander things with the program as well.
You do charge for it. Well, you kind of you charge, pay what you will, but you have a suggested fee.
That's right.
Yeah.
The source code is always available free of charge, either by downloading the source code tarball release that we do, or by fetching it from our development repositories. But as of sometime in the beginning of this year, I did switch over to a scheme that somebody called the pay tunnel, which I thought was a rather nice term for this, where essentially I am trying to put people on the spot a little bit when they download.
Mm-hmm.
It's modeled a little bit on the experiment that Radiohead did last year,
right,
within Rainbows, essentially saying, okay, you can download this, but we want you to actually say how much you intend to pay for it. And it's fine to say that you'll pay nothing, but we want you to actually go on the record, so to speak, and say, I'm going to pay nothing, or I'm going to pay $1 or $10.
Right.
The average price that people pay at the present time, it's been fairly constant, is somewhere between $10 and $12 per copy.
Instead of you suggest 55, which is, by the way, what I paid. But
it's actually a random number.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
So if I came back, it could have been less or could have been more.
I don't remember what the range is right now. I think it's any multiple of five, somewhere between 35 and 65.
Oh, how funny.
But no, it is a random number. The key thing to remember, though, and this is where things get a little interesting for me for the long term. At the moment, we only have about 3% of downloaders who actually pay anything.
This is something. Part of the reason why I wanted to get Paul, I was interested in having Paul come on the show, is the fact that Ardour to me is such a phenomenal project, and the work that Paul and the community has done has been so intense. I was talking to him a few weeks back and said, you know, so are you still able to work on this full time? And he said, you know, I am, but you know, it's getting a bit tough. We need more donations. So I just think it's an interesting story about Ardour, and I wanted to get Paul on to talk about this side as well. So how can people contribute to help you keep on hacking it during the day? Is donations the best way to do this, Paul?
The best way to do this is by signing up for what we call a subscription. This basically says that you'll pay a certain amount per month for 12 months. And the reason why this works so much better than actually simply paying for a download is it actually provides some continuous income over a period of time.
Yeah.
It makes it much more easy to actually say, okay, at least for the next 6 months, it looks like there'll be this much revenue coming in. Certainly, obviously, paying for the download is also great. I think we have a moderately significant number of users who choose to not pay at the time that they download, and then come back later on to actually make some kind of a donation. I don't know if any of you have used it enough yet, but if you also get all the way through a project to the point where you export it, recent versions of the program will come up with a little, hopefully rather polite, nag screen right after the export is done, and basically say, now that you've, you know, actually finished something to the point where you exported it, perhaps you'd like to go ahead and either subscribe or make some kind of a donation.
Yep.
The thing with the finances of this that's very difficult is that you know, people's income levels all around the world vary by huge amounts. I'm based in the United States, and if I decided to switch away from Ardour and I went back into sort of regular paid work, you know, realistically, somebody with my experience right now would be expect to earn somewhere between probably $80,000 and $160,000 a year. The problem is that Ardour has an audience that extends to places where, you know, the annual salary might be perhaps $5,000. It gets very tricky to have a public website that actually talks about real, you know, actual, real solid amounts of money when the context for understanding this is hard to reach, you know, all around the world. There have been a couple of comments from people saying, good grief, and, you know, he makes $4,500 a month from this program already. You know, I don't earn anything close to that. And those are all great comments, really. It's just that you know, being based in the US, the only reasonable salary comparisons, I think, are to what you could earn as a software developer in the US.
$54,000 a year is not that much in Bala Cynwyd money.
It's not.
You're not asking a lot of money, I got to tell you.
No, I'm not. And I, at the moment, I'm trying to set goals low enough that, right. you know, that we maybe reach them. But there is this long-term problem with open source software. Let me just talk about this away from Ardor for a moment. The way I think about open source projects is that there are really three kinds of them. There are those that are big enough or valuable enough that corporations of some kind exist and will pay people to actually work on them. So the kernel is one great example.
Right.
We've got companies like Red Hat and Canonical and so on, who are in a position where they can actually pay people to work on the kernel. There's also companies like IBM, who simply, they regard it as in their best interest to pay people to work on the kernel. You've also got big projects like Firefox and so on, where there are other, you know, commercial interests lined up that make it clear it's worth paying software developers to sit down and work on this program because we will get some kind of benefit from it. Then you've got a different set of programs. And the one that I like to quote a lot, just because I think it's such a great little program, is something called SoundJuicer. I don't know whether or not you're familiar with it. When I first saw SoundJuicer, I thought, wow, you know, this is just fantastic. It's this tiny little program that just does one thing. It has a super simple interface to it, very easy to use, does the job really, really well. I don't know how long it actually took to write, but it's a very self-contained program. There's probably a maintainer for it right now who probably does one or two patches every few months. Those are sort of these hobby projects where we can legitimately get stuff done. We can get a useful program out in a month or two of somebody working on it at night, and we can keep it maintained over a period of time by people just casually, you know, throwing patches in and so on and so forth. So that type of project gets handled by people who just want to do this stuff for the love of it. But then there's this other whole set of programs, and Ardor is one of them, GIMP is another one, Inkscape is another one, and they don't really fit into either category very well. What corporations really benefit from Ardor's existence? It's hard to think of many. Who wants to see Inkscape move forward in big and dramatic ways? It's really hard to pin that down too. But these are big, complicated programs that to make continued forward progress, you've got to have people actually really working on them, you know, if not full-time, then very close to it. And you probably need more than one person. And I think it's a little bit of an unsolved challenge in the open source world right now. How do we get that to happen with this category of program? The experiment with Ardor so far, relatively speaking, has been incredibly successful. But I think, as you just noted, it's not a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know, the goal isn't that high here.
And are you working on this full time, Paul, right now?
Yeah. I wake up in the morning and I go do Ardor. And I think if you talk to my wife and kids, they'd probably say it was more than full time.
Yeah. And digital audio workstations are notoriously expensive. I mean, even Audition's $400.
Well,
you talk Pro Tools, you're talking thousands.
That's beginning to change, though. You've got the influence of programs like Reaper, for example, which is a very cool piece of software. I think that the personal license for that is $50. Reaper's right. been attracting a lot of interest from people. It is beginning to change. But yes, you're absolutely right. Traditionally, they've been rather expensive. In the case of Pro Tools, you also, if you want to go all the way with Pro Tools, you actually have to buy specialized hardware
right.
that has huge margins as well. So...
So that brings us to another question in terms of hardware. So if somebody wants to build out a little studio and they want to go and buy like a FireWire desk to like a control surface, and they're going to want to buy maybe a decent sound card, like one of the Delta 1010s, is that kind of hardware going to work? And is it going to work with Ardor?
Let me think of the best way to answer this question. There is a nice range of semi-pro or professional audio interfaces that are going to work with Ardor on Linux. They include the M-Audio Delta 1010 that you mentioned. That's one of the best supported interfaces around. All of the RME HDSP series or the Hammerfall series, they all work on Linux as well. Most of the other M-Audio PCI cards work very well too. There are sets of devices out there that just don't work. The classic one is Motu, who have been very aggressively negative about having any Linux support. I mean, I actually met with them personally at a trade show 5 or 6 years ago, and I have to say it was one of the most appalling experiences I've had interacting with any company. I mean, they were just insulting and rude about the idea that anyone would want to use their stuff on Linux. And I'm being polite in my description here. So
what was the name of the company?
Motu, M-O-T-U. And I use their gear, but I'm going to stop using their gear. I can tell you right now. That's very disappointing because they sell a DAW themselves. And maybe that's why. I don't, but it's hard to believe.
But that may be true. Hold on just 1 second, guys.
They have a program, a fairly expensive program called Audio Producer, which is actually very good, and I've used it. I have the same experience though with that I do with all of these. They're way over my head. I'm not very sophisticated.
They also made Digital Performer.
That's what I meant. Performer, yes, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Digital Performer. Yeah. In the case of PCI based cards, there's quite a nice range of choices and. Many of the most commonly used cards for any platform are going to work on Linux with Otter. On OS X, where Otter runs as well, basically anything that works on OS X works with Otter, so you don't even have to really think about that. The only place where this begins to get a little tricky now in terms of us providing advice is if people are using laptops, and this is where stuff gets more complicated. I'm not a big fan of USB audio. I haven't been for a long time. I think it was a really bad technical standard for moving audio in and out of computers, and it's unfortunate that so many manufacturers jumped on the bandwagon and said, hey, this is great, you know, and they've built all these nice cheap little boxes that people love when it's just really rather poor technology. However, that being said, most of those interfaces work quite well on Linux at this point. There is a device standard for them. And so as long as those boxes people buy are compliant with that standard, which almost all of them are, then you just plug that into your Linux box and it will work. You do sometimes have to be a little more careful about your choice of parameters that you use. Most of them only run at a 48 kilohertz sample rate, for example. But in general, they all work. And if they don't work, then we can tell you how to make them work fairly easily. Slightly more complex are the FireWire boxes. Technically, these are much better as far as ways to move audio in and out of the computer, but there's no standard here, at least no standard that you can write some single driver for. Fortunately, a guy from Belgium, Peter Parmers, has spent several years now working on driver support for these, and we're at the point now where lots of those boxes are supported on Linux, but they're not fully supported. They're supported to the extent you can get audio and MIDI in and out of the box. They're not necessarily supported in the sense that there may be some specific aspects of the unit you bought, some knobs on the front or some buttons or switches and so on, that you can't control from software. Peter's had a fair amount of support from the manufacturers in this case. There's a website, fado.org, FFADO.org, where his project is based, and you can go have a look there and check if a particular interface is currently supported or not. It would be very nice to see Fado move ahead to the point where we could just say, oh, everything works. That's likely to be some time off right now. So if somebody is thinking about buying a FireWire interface, the thing to do first is go and visit the Fado website, check if it's supported, check how good the support appears to be, and then make your decisions based on that.
We have a couple of questions from the chat room, if you don't mind, Paul. People have some technical questions. CLC Radio, a radio guy, asks if the Echo line of cards work with Arter. Do you know that?
I Echo. Believe that certainly the earlier PCI cards do.
Mm-hmm.
The best place to check that, there's another website you can check, which is ALSA-project.org,
mm-hmm.
I believe. And they have a sound card support matrix that has a list of all the sound cards known, whether they're currently supported, and what the status of the support is. I certainly know that the Echo, things like Layla and some of the other Echo boxes of that generation all work just fine.
So it's really a Linux support issue, not an Ardor support issue.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And in fact, just on a geeky technical note, Ardor doesn't actually even interact with your sound card at all. You can run Ardor on a machine that has no sound card whatsoever. It only interacts with Jack, which I mentioned earlier.
Right.
And so if you have Jack running on your machine and it routes the audio out over your network, then you can run Ardor with no sound card at all. So right. This is absolutely not an Ardor issue. It's just a matter of whether your sound card is supported by Linux itself.
Will Jack support multiple sound cards?
Jack is primarily targeted at working with a single sound card.
Okay.
When you're working with digital audio, it's very important to make sure you have a single sample clock that drives all of your equipment. When you start to try to do this with multiple cheap consumer sound cards, it's difficult to actually guarantee that is the case. If, however, you use higher end semi-pro professional sound cards that you can sync up properly, it's quite possible to actually make Jack work with that type of configuration as well.
How about running in virtualization?
That does not, to the best of my knowledge, most of the virtualization environments right now don't provide very good support for audio I/O, right. And therefore Jack itself doesn't tend to run very well.
And finally, somebody wants to know, why no Windows version? You've got Mac, you've got Linux.
That's a long and a short story. So I'll try to go for the medium
yeah,
answer.
What's the difference? Yeah.
The best explanation of it really is in an essay by Bryce Harrington, who's one of the lead authors of Inkscape, which, mm-hmm. if you guys don't know, is sort of a bit like Adobe Illustrator.
Right.
It's a very, very, very nice vector graphics program. Bryce made the observation that when they finally ported Inkscape over to Windows, their community of developers and users grew massively, yeah. very quickly, which is not surprising since at least 9 out of 10 computer users worldwide run Windows. The problem is that when you draw in people from the Linux crowd, and to some extent the OS X crowd, you tend to keep a fairly nice mixture of people who are able and willing to contribute to problem solving, bug fixing, making various contributions to the project in some way, and people who are just regular plain users who don't want to get involved in that. Right. They just want to use the software. Right. As soon as Inkscape had a Windows port, they found themselves overrun by people who had no technical background whatsoever,
right.
who just wanted to use that program. And from Bryce's perspective, it was a fairly negative hit on their community. Now, some other Inkscape developers may not feel the same way, but when I read Bryce's account of how this happened, it struck me that exactly the same thing would happen with Ardor.
Right.
And we just don't have a community right now that could deal with that. When I go look online and I read the forums for other pieces of audio software like Digital Performer or Sonar or right. Cubase, I would say a good 20% of all the questions in there end up being problems just with Windows.
Right.
They aren't really, really problems with the application software. And so unless somebody was willing to step up and say, not only will we help create the Windows port, we will also help build and maintain a community of people that will support that environment. It just isn't viable for us to do that if we want to continue to pay attention to Windows on a Mac.
It's too many people. It's kind of counterintuitive. It's too much.
Yeah.
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 And too many less sophisticated users. And I think that makes a lot of sense, actually.
Yeah. And I mean, those people are certainly who we're targeting. It's right. just that you can't suddenly take in 1,000 new people who don't have much of a clue when you've only gained one person who's able to help address right. some of the problems that they're having.
Support issues become huge, I'm sure, for any That's Windows right. program. You do a great thing, though. I have to say, on the website, you get people to sponsor issues. So this is another way to raise money that I think is pretty clever, pretty innovative. So if there's something you want, you can pay. You know, you can say, "Hey,
absolutely,
yeah, pay attention,
absolutely." And it was a feature we added about, I don't know, three or four months ago now. It has its pluses and its minuses. It's a very nice system, as you just said. The idea that you can say, "Oh, well, you know, this particular feature or this particular bug is very important to me, and so I will help pay to, you know, make sure it gets fixed or implemented." The downside of this goes back to the financial stuff we were talking about earlier, which is, how does somebody really know how much to pay?
Right.
It gets very hard. I've explained to people online a few times that often with bugs, sometimes as much as 90% of the work in solving a bug is actually just investigating it. You know, you try to understand when it happens, why it happens, what are the particular circumstances, and so on. And eventually, the answer suddenly is blindingly obvious, and you go in and you change two lines of code and the problem's fixed. So in terms of the amount of time you spend actually changing code, well, you know, how much can you reasonably charge for right. changing two lines of code? Mm. The problem is that you just spend 4 hours ahead of time trying to dig into the problem and figure it out.
Right.
And for a lot of people, the idea of paying, let's say, you know, $100 for one bug to be fixed seems a little strange or excessive. Again, this is very much based on where you live worldwide. What would be really wonderful, I mean, if I was to fantasize about, you know, the glorious future of Ardor, if we actually had a larger development community with more people worldwide, yes, I'm talking about outsourcing here, folks. I'm talking about having a crowd of developers who actually will be extremely happy to work on a bug for 4 or 5 hours and earn $20. Then I think this system will really start to work incredibly well, because that will line up with what users' expectations are. They don't mind throwing in $5 to try to fix something.
It could be interesting. It could be interesting to kind of like, you know, like when you plan any piece of software, you identify milestones and you say, we want to have this set of features done by this date and things like that. It'd be good if people could sponsor towards milestones. Like if you could say, okay, the next version of Ardor is going to have these features. This is what we're planning.
Then there'd never be a new release.
Yeah. But I'm just thinking whether it would be a good way to kind of like, so people, because everyone, like you say, everyone's got their pet features. And like being realistic, I'm probably not going to pay any money for Ardor I'm never going to see your donate button, because they get it through my distribution. Right. Whereas if in the program it could somehow identify new and exciting features, and I think, oh, that would be really, really interesting, I'd want to contribute to getting that paid for.
You actually mean while you're inside the program, or just somehow?
Conceivably, because I think there's a problem right now in the fact that, you know, I'm not a big fan of NAG dialogue boxes in any software. Uh-huh. But one of the problems, of course, is the fact that I could conceivably never see your website, because I get my Ardor from Absolutely. Ubuntu or wherever else. And one thing that we should think about as distributors is, how can we channel your revenue campaigns into the distro? Right. So, you know, we should be able to really be able to connect your revenue campaign on your website somehow through Ubuntu. So you can still do it.
This goes back to an interesting conversation I remember having at one of the Linux Architects meetings several years ago in Portland. I was talking to a guy who at the time was working for Mozilla, and then subsequently gone on and worked for a bunch of other, you know, big marquee projects. And there was a discussion there amongst a whole bunch of, you know, of Linux bigwigs about the whole issue of third-party software developers and how they interact with distributions. And this guy was saying, you know, really, from the perspective of Mozilla, we don't really want their distribution involved at all. Mm. You know, they're basically taking our product and it gets repackaged and then they ship it out to people. And they basically, he wasn't saying, you know, we're cut out of the loop and we don't like that. But that from their perspective, you know, their distributions don't add anything of value. They may add something of value to the user, but for the third part of the software developer, they really don't. And it's a tension that I've seen with Arda as well. I mean, I'm very much aware of the fact that, you know, certainly on Linux, well, so we only run on two platforms, but I mean, on Linux in particular, my guess is 90% of all the people that use Arda have fetched it from the distribution.
Yeah.
So as you just said, how do you interpose any sort of notion that maybe there should be a revenue stream associated with this program into that process? Because currently the distribution package mechanisms are just not based around that idea. Everything is free of charge all the time. We have talked, I mean, the Arda developers have talked about the idea of us bringing out our own statically built version of Arda, and that we would actually just simply start to mention that and cite that as the version that we support. And if you fetch it from your distribution, then you get support from your distribution, not from us. That has some merits for us in the sense that it would tend to drag a few people back to the website. But then again, how many people? And I'm not really that interested in turning around and telling, let's say, 60% of our users, oh, well, we won't support you.
Yeah.
It sounds like a terrible and crippling world of pain if that was happening in my mind.
You speak as somebody who represents a distribution.
Yeah. It just purely from the perspective of, you know, so using Ubuntu as an example, when you get Arda from Ubuntu, of course, you get its dependency chain, and those dependencies, right. You know, there's those dependencies are kind of built and generally maintained in the distribution to varying degrees. Whereas obviously if there's just one single upstream, then you're having to deal with one single statically linked copy, and then it's running on all these different platforms, and there's usually kinds of integration issues. But
absolutely, yeah, absolutely. And know, I'm always amazed whenever I come across it, any application that actually does this static build, and it actually works, it always totally freaks me out. Oh my God, they actually made it work properly.
Well, we should definitely talk more about how we can see if there's ways in which we can find a middle ground around this, because I think this is an important problem to solve. You know, so.
Yeah, I mean, certainly that issue, as you said, of, you know, people don't even see the website. I mean, there's a whole question of how legitimate is it, for example, to have Arda phone home? You know, in the past, you know, quite a few people have raised objections to having any program arbitrarily use your network connection. So would it be all right if Arda occasionally pops up a little box and says, may I, you know, redirect your web browser to Arda.org, or can, you know, is it all right if I just register the fact that you're using this copy? There's a number of things like that that would sort of help to shift people's attention over to what's going on the website. But there definitely is a conundrum here, and I think it's particularly acute, as I said, for these big, complicated programs like the GIMP, like Inkscape, like Arda, and so on, where the distributions have really been set up around the idea of free of cost software, but then there's no revenue model to actually pay for the development to continue. It's a hard problem.
It's a tough one, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it sounds like irrespective of the challenges that you faced, technical and revenue and whatever else, it sounds like you've got a really rocking project on your hands. No, well, pun intended.
Let me just ask you a couple of technical questions, because our audience likes to hear about your development environment. What is it written in?
It's almost entirely written in C++. Mm-hmm. We do use some assembler for the most CPU intensive stuff, which amazingly enough is metering. For you audio geeks back there.
That makes sense, because that's really real time, isn't it?
For metering, we have to look at every single sample that goes through the program and compare it to a minimum and a maximum value of all the other samples that are going through. So we use assembler for those completely critical things, but only for those. There is some C floating around as well, just for various reasons. And then we have a few tools that are not part of the program, but that hang out around the edges that are generally written in Perl or Python.
And you develop in, you have an IDE you use, you use Emacs. What do you work
Please.
With?
Whoopa.
Emacs.
Emacs. Okay.
And who needs anything else?
And really? That's all anybody really needs.
That's all anybody really needs.
I just ask.
I've been programming now. I've been programming now for nearly, I don't know, 23 years or something. And I came across Emacs probably in about 1986 or so. And I haven't left it since.
Command line Emacs.
No, I
oh,
do.
Okay, Emacs.
I do actually have a window all of its own, and the mouse does things if I really need it to.
Only as a last resort.
Right, and so then for building, we used the version 2 of Arda. We use Escont, mm-hmm. Which is a very nice change for us from using the Auto Tools system. Some people call it Auto Hell. And I would subscribe to that description. We switched away from that. Then we found that actually even Escont for us had its own problems. One of the biggest issues is that it really gets in the way of what is generally called this sort of edit, compile, debug cycle, where you're just sort of sitting in a loop, right. You write some code or change some code, you compile it, you test it out. Escont takes a long time to do that. And there are good reasons why it does, because, you know, Escont has some goals about repeatable builds and various other things that are very suitable for sort of corporate software that will run telephone switches, but are not very helpful for things where you've got guys, you know, sitting in a very tight work cycle. So for version 3, we've switched to using, I guess I should call it WAF or WAF. I'm never sure quite how we're supposed to say that. And WAF has been fantastic. It basically gave us all the benefits of Escont without any of the disadvantages and got us away from all of the pain of using Auto Hell. It took me probably 4, 5, 6 hours to really get comfortable with WAF. It was a very worthwhile investment, and I recommend it to anybody out there.
And do you use a versioning system?
We use SVN right now. There's a few people who've built Git repositories that I guess are branched off of, or, you know, have that relationship with SVN, but the official repo is SVN.
That's all the questions I have. I'm channeling Randall here.
I think I'm all out.
Yeah. I've downloaded it, Paul, and I'm going to try it tonight. I think it's way over my head.
I'm going to sweat.
Well, I'm not going to give it a...
I won't be able to sleep properly.
Oh,
no,
please. I'm not going to give it a bad review, obviously. It looks like it's amazing software, but to be honest, you know, all I'm really doing is basically a digital analog of cutting with the razor. Yep. Taping it down, going to the next one, cutting with the razor, taping it down, which is how I learned many,
that
many years
ago. That was
what I did.
That was what I used to do in my teens as well.
Yeah. Wasn't in my teens.
I'd like to mention one other thing while we're here,
sure,
which
Paul.
Is one of the things I didn't touch on when we were talking about what Arda was. The program as it stands now is audio only. And this is one of the reasons why many people, you know, haven't moved over to using it, because in comparison with something like Cubase or Sonar or Digital Performer, those things all handle audio and MIDI.
Right.
Version 3 of the program, which we've been working on furiously for a large number of years now, version 3 does support MIDI.
Ah.
And so you will be able to record, edit, playback, and so on and so forth with MIDI. We don't think that we can match Logic on our first release. I'm sure that will come as no surprise to anyone. The existing sequencers, like Logic and like Cubase, have had a good, I don't know, 12, 15 years right now, at least, to evolve their editing stuff. But I'm pretty confident that the first version, which I hope to get out in alpha within the next few weeks, will provide the sort of basic MIDI editing features that most people are going to need. It'll do quantization. It'll do step editing. You know, you can adjust note lengths and move things around on a pitch scale and so forth. And we hope that this will be another huge step for Arda, and it will help to draw in people who maybe need to be a little more focused on MIDI, but still need some audio work as well. How well it works for everyone, we need to wait and see. It's been a long time coming. We had Google Summer of Code sponsorships for this two summers in a row.
Right.
It was a big enough change in the way that the program works internally. It's taken us a long time to get to the place we are now, which is not quite ready to have people use it, but we're almost there.
So that's just a few weeks off, Ardor 3.
There'll be an alpha version out in a few weeks, and okay. I really do mean alpha here, in the sense that we'll be putting it out there to basically get more back traces of crashes and so on.
Right.
There'll be a beta, I would imagine, you know, perhaps a month after the alpha comes out.
But you can get Ardor 2.5 right now at ardour.org.
2.8.
All right. Yeah. I'm looking at an old screenshot. 2.8 is now available for you. Set your own cost. And if you don't like the cost, refresh, because I... whatever. It's different every time. If I had only known. Or in your case, if it had only been $105 instead of $55, I would have been... I'd have paid whatever it was, because, frankly, these are much less expensive and much better supported than the commercial products, I think.
Well, thank you for your support of the project.
Of course. Thank you, Paul Davis, for joining us. ardour.org. Good luck. I hope we don't bring your server down. I know there's quite a few people went there right now to get a copy of it.
I think we can take it.
Good.
Thanks very much, guys.
Thanks, Paul. Take care.
Thanks, Paul. Take
Bye-bye.
Care.
Bye-bye. Balakinwood. I've been to Balakinwood. It's a beautiful area. And I don't know how he lives on $54,000 a year in Balakinwood. I mean, that's the thing. That's almost sad in a way, because to have to say, oh, you know, we need this money, and people say, well, that's way too much. This guy's trying to make a living doing something that is very difficult and very complex.
And he's like one of the top two people in Linux audio like development as well. I mean, there's another guy called Steve Harris. It's like, you know, I don't think he wasn't underestimating. He could earn a lot of money if he was doing this.
Exactly.
Writing proprietary software. So he's really committing his life to the course, and I admire him for that.
Let's support him, kids.
Yeah.
And you know, if I weren't so brain dead, I'd be able to use some of these more sophisticated DAWs, but I just can't figure them out. I try. But I have very simple needs. I do multi-track recording, but then we're just cutting and editing. But I have some smart editors upstairs, and I'll make sure they take a look at it. Maybe they'll prefer it. I think what we're going to do actually for our stuff is we're going to start working in Final Cut with the video, and the audio edit will be almost a subsidiary of the full video edit. Why do both? You know, do one at a time.
Yeah. I've looked to move to Ardor, but there's still a few things that it doesn't do that I need.
Yeah, he mentioned that. So hard to get a feature set that everybody's going to be happy with.
But it's certainly 90% of the way there. I mean, it's details.
So. Impressive. Well, I'm just looking at the screenshots. And I did download it, and I'll be installing it. Mm. So he raised a very interesting question, and I had never really thought about this. But to their opinion, there's some negatives to being part of a distro.
Yeah. I've heard this from a few people, you know, so a few people have said, you know, distros, you know, either distros take all the credit for something, or, you know, some distributions will rename a piece of software, you know, from Firefox possibly to web browser or something like that. So there's branding issues.
Well, I can understand that, but you would think being issues. Part of a distro would be such an advantage.
That's what I've always thought, but, you know, I guess that's why I work for a distro. I mean, to me, it's, you know, the main value that distros bring is that they bring users. I mean, they put the software in the hands of people. But there are definitely details. I mean, you know, one of the members of my team, we spent quite some time working with improving the relationship between upstreams in terms of technical bug workflow. And just some of the details, some of the technical workflow elements, you know, there's lots of subtle things that need to be considered. And I think it's always getting better, but there's always going to be a little bit of attention there. But it always surprises me because, you know, when I've written upstream software before, I've always thought, I'd love it to be in a distro. You know, I'd love it to be featured.
So. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, as a user, we love it.
Yeah.
And I think in the long run, I would lobby these guys. It's a similar situation, in a lot of different areas. I think about podcasters who say, oh, you know, we want to control the distribution versus me who say, just get it to as many ears as possible. record companies, you know, who are really trying to hold on. I think in the long run, you just have to have faith that getting it out there in the long run is the best. But boy, you really, when you're a small team, like clearly as Ardor is, support becomes a huge issue.
Yeah.
And I thought it was very interesting. Also, they said, we're not going to do Windows because it will end up eating us alive.
Yeah, it's interesting how you get these fragmented groups as well. So you may have Ardor upstream that some people use and they'll download for Mac or whatever. And then you'll have Ardor in distributions and then little pockets of support will open up in different distributions.
Right.
And ultimately, all distros want to connect that with upstream. But sometimes upstream don't want any of that.
Right.
So it's complex.
This is why you must read The Art of Community, Jono's book. This is because ultimately that's what this all is. It's managing community.
It is. And it's I think, building great communities all about setting expectations. Mm. And one thing I like about Paul, that's the first time I spoke to him.
I understand. That's the problem with Windows users. Their expectations are way too high.
Completely misaligned. That's the thing I like about Paul is he is very keen on setting expectations and making sure that everyone understands where we stand. And I think it's an admirable project. And yes, The Art of Community can help for all of your needs, community and otherwise. Available on Amazon.
I was just going to say that. From O'Reilly, you make sure you get your copy.
Go and get it.
Go and get it from Jono Bacon. Jono is the community manager at Ubuntu and knows better than anybody the art of managing community, I'll tell you. And the variant, I've been covering the open source community and kind of using open source software for years. And Paul raised some issues that I'd never even thought about, And of course,
you learn something new.
You do. You always learn something new. And this very difficult, thorny issue of monetization.
Yeah. That's something I'm really, really keen to talk to you more about because I think we do need to think of a better way for distros to work closer with upstreams to help deal with these kind of issues. So,
I think there's this kind of belief among users that, well, you do open source for the love of it. You don't do it for a living. You all have day jobs, right?
Mm.
And that clearly that's not the case. There's a huge variety of needs and people and reasons why they do it.
So yeah, absolutely.
It's good for us to talk to them. Jono, I'm so glad you were here. I appreciate it. We miss Randall. He'll be back next week. He's on the job.
It's weird when he's not around. It's weird.
Nobody's talking like Kermit. It's weird when he is around. So
it is weird when he is around and when he's not around.
It's the same.
Two different types of weird.
No. See, he's very sensitive.
He is.
We're just joking, Randall. We love
him. He cries a lot.
He's very sensitive. Jono Bacon, always a pleasure. We thank you all for joining us. Don't forget, you can watch us do this show. We do it live on our Twit stream at live.twit.tv. All you need is Flash. I realize it's not open source, but as far as I know, there are no yet Og Theora streaming websites. But as soon as they figure that out, I'm there, baby. actually, I'm hoping, and I've said this before, I don't like the fact that we have to do this on Flash. It's just what Ustream and Stickam and BitGravity and all the providers do. But I'm looking forward to, at some point, somebody in the HTML5 community saying, this is the video codec, and starting to do HTML5 streaming.
I think they picked Og.
Did they pick Og?
For Firefox, at least.
That's great news. I hope that
could be an option. I'd need to double check that, but I think we're heading in the right direction anyway.
Yeah. And can Theora stream?
I don't know. My knowledge of Theora is that it's called Og Theora.
Mine as well. Always a pleasure. Join us, as I was saying, live.twit.tv. You will need Flash, sorry to say. We do this at 4:30 Eastern, 1:30 Pacific, every Wednesday at http://live.twit.tv. I'm Leo Laporte. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week on Floss Weekly.